This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College, the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative, and a current Soros Justice Fellow. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking with Tina Natto, who is the executive director of the Association of Maine Criminal Defense Lawyers, and I will say very beloved in the Maine community of folks who I network with. Today, we're going to be talking about dissent in a country where democracy, the rule of law, free speech, and the right to protest are all under direct attack from the federal government. So, Tina, welcome to the show. So glad to have you.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you for inviting me.
We're going to begin by getting to know you a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to be a criminal defense attorney, and tell us a little bit about your current legal practice.
Sure. So I am a true blood Mainer. I grew up in Madawaska, way up in northern Maine. My mom grew up in South Portland. My dad's from the valley up north. So I am through and through a Mainer. I grew up there. I went to Bowdoin College, which can't really get more Maine than that. No offense, Catherine. I know you're a Colby professor, but got to rep my polar bears here. I did a few things before I landed in my legal career. I think the most important of which was teaching high school English, mostly English, at a public high school in the Mississippi Delta for several years. So through that experience, seeing that Brown versus Board of Education really hasn't touched segregation in education in the country at all, and just seeing how the entrenched racism impacted my students, seeing how their lives often intersected or their families' lives intersected with the criminal legal system. From that experience, I got pretty committed pretty quickly to the idea of wanting to do more than I was able to do as a teacher. And I thought being a lawyer, becoming a lawyer, was a way for me to really try to address some of these issues in a way that I thought would be more effective. Some days I question that, but that was definitely my intent in going to law school. As far as law school, I ended up going to the University of Maine School of Law here in Portland. Word to the wise. We do have a law school here in Maine. I didn't know that until I started applying to law schools. And it's a great school. It's a small school, has a lot of non-traditional students. I was a non-traditional student, having worked for 6 or 7 years between college and law school. I never say take a break. A lot of people says, well, I took a break. And no, I worked. I actually did good in the world, I think, and tried my best for several years before figuring out what I wanted to do. So at Maine Law, pretty early on, I knew I wanted to focus on criminal law. I knew I wanted to represent human beings. I knew I wanted to stand up to bullies, which by and large are the state, police, and things like that. So I really focused on things like evidence and trial practice, and took every opportunity I could, which was very limited, to gain some practical experience in the criminal law. We did not have any public defender's offices back then. We didn't really have any established externship or internships for criminal defense. The best forum to actually get some experience, shockingly enough, was through the district attorney's office in Portland. So for about a year and a half, I worked at that office as a student attorney, prosecuted cases, dismissed a lot of cases, and focused for at least a chunk of my time there on domestic violence cases. So I have my perspective on the criminal legal system is informed by my experience at the DA's office. I don't begrudge my time there. I just knew after finishing there that I could not do that for a living. Essentially, at the end of the day, when we're in a carceral system, the default is always going to be incarceration. And to have me be the one who decides whether or not somebody goes to jail is just something I didn't want to pursue in my career. I then worked for the Maine Supreme Judicial Court. I was a law clerk for the law court. So Maine Supreme Court in Portland. I did that for a year. I worked for a small firm for a couple of years, but since 2015, I opened my own practice. I focus exclusively on criminal defense. The vast majority of my work has been indigent criminal defense. So representing people who are entitled to counsel, but who cannot afford counsel. I've represented people from the silliest, smallest, should never be a crime infractions, all the way up to allegations involving murder. I am my favorite boss that I've ever had. I'm not always the best employee, but I really do enjoy working for myself, getting to determine my schedule, my caseload. And then, in addition, I work as the executive director of the Maine Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I've been doing that since 2017. My practice right now is kind of taking a little bit of a backseat because we're in the middle of the legislative session. So I've been working on testimony and really getting MacDill's positions and goals out there
Okay.
regarding a host of bills that are before the legislature this year. Without mentioning any of them by name, there's
Got it.
just a lot going on. So it's a busy time of year for a lot of people who care about these issues.
I want to circle back to that specific question, but I want to just pause for a minute. You used the term, we're living in a carceral system. And I wonder if you can parse that a bit for our listeners. What does that mean to you to say that we are living in a carceral system or that we are living in a carceral society?
Right. So, and I'm talking to an expert here who introduces herself as an abolitionist scholar, which is kind of a framework for understanding that the system that we are operating in, the default is incarceration. So, when I say carceral, meaning that at the end of the day, that is the thing that makes something criminal, is the threat of incarceration, the threat of jail, the threat of imprisonment. That is always there. Because we live in a carceral system, if somebody is unhoused, mentally ill, or addicted to substances, we do not have the resources to address those issues and support these people in the community, but we sure always have a jail bed for them. We address a lot of those issues through the criminal legal system in a way I find extremely destructive, extremely traumatic, and really ineffective. The carceral system that I think we're operating in is inherently violent. There's violence by keeping people under lock and key. That's never to say there aren't good people trying to do their best within that system, but the system itself is corrupt and evil. And because of that, until we kind of unshackle ourselves from this framework, I really don't think we're ever going to get to a place where we feel safe and people are actually able to break free from the trauma.
So what I understand you to be saying, and of course I completely agree with this way of framing things, is that we live in a system that uses the threat of punishment, carceral punishment, punishment as incarceration, as a form of social control. And so people who deviate in a wide variety of ways, and that can include protest, that can include anything that the federal government or the state government decides to criminalize, any kinds of activities that are perceived or come to be defined by an administration as disloyal or problematic or disruptive, can be criminalized. And then those individuals can be made subject to prosecution and to imprisonment. So overall, it's really a tool of social control, and the way that it's wielded really depends on who's in charge. So I'm wondering now if we can step to a really big picture question, which is how would you describe our current political reality in the United States? I mean, you say we live in a carceral system. How have things shifted for you under this current administration from your perspective? What is it? What are we living within right now?
I think with this current administration, the Trump administration, what we're seeing is all the worst impulses of America just heightened. Everything is at a different level at this point. The way we have, as a country, engaged with and criminalized and horrified, honestly, immigrants to this country. That's something that President Biden, President Obama, I mean, if you want to go back, we've been awful on those issues for a long time. But with Trump, we're seeing it heightened. It's very performative and it's very scary. And I think when you have people in power who take true pleasure in inflicting cruelty against the most vulnerable among us, including trans people, undocumented immigrants, et cetera, it starts to get, I understand why people are terrified. And I think people are smart to be terrified because there's no limit. There's no inherent limit to who the targets will be. And when it's always chaos, it's hard to get footing to take the stand that we need to address the major things coming down, because we're just trying to catch our breath and figure out what's coming from which angle. And I think that this administration thrives on chaos. They thrive on coercion. Again, these are things that I think are inherent in America, in our government, and the way that we've proceeded for these centuries. But with this particular administration, we're led by very incompetent and cruel people. And those two things together can lead to a lot of harm. And a lot of that harm might be irreparable.
Yeah, thank you for painting a bleak picture. I mean, you're absolutely right. I share your views. Thinking about the way in which coercion is wielded, it can be wielded a number of ways, but the two that come to mind that are relevant to our conversation are coercion in the form of a threat of punishment if you don't obey, but also coercion by punishing and threatening the more marginalized and the more vulnerable as an object lesson to the rest of us, right? If you don't step in line, look what I can do to them. And that puts all of us on notice that we could be next. So coercion is an extraordinarily violent tactic to use against a population trying to find its footing in a sea of chaos, as you say. So what's the role of the organization that you lead, the Association of Maine Criminal Defense Lawyers, in this political landscape?
Thank you. So MACDL, as we call ourselves, because if we don't have an acronym, apparently we all die. So MACDL is a trade organization, by and large. It was established in 1992 to band together the criminal defense bar of the state to put on continuing legal education. So making sure we're all educated on the latest developments in the law, to make sure we have a forum like a listserv so we can share information. We have motions and brief banks so people can, you know, look at that to get ideas for templates or for research or what have you. So we have like a very resource heavy, supportive of the work of criminal defense thing. Like that's the primary focus of our organization. The other focus is legislative efforts. So we focus mostly in the state. We don't really go federal here because there's so much work to do in the state. And most of us are state practitioners, meaning our clients are facing state charges in state courts by state prosecutors. So in every legislative session, there are a panoply of bills presented that could be particularly harmful to our clients, and a smaller group of bills that could be very helpful for our clients. So during the course of the legislative session, we have a small group of us who essentially volunteer our time to provide testimony, provide support to the sponsors or other stakeholders, and really stand firm for the goals of the organization, which are not just to represent criminal defense attorneys, but the interests of our clients and people in general who are impacted by any infringement of our liberties. I think the Fifth Amendment is demonstrative in that way, because it says any person, right? We're talking about everyone. And as soon as one person is denied due process, as soon as one person is denied fairness, we're all at risk. And I think MACDL has been a leader in standing firm against the onslaught and the impulses of people, I think, to over penalize folks accused of crimes, forgetting that presumption of innocence thing. So legislation is tough, you know, because it depends on a popular vote, really. So our clients are not particularly popular, and I think we're right behind them in popularity. People do not love criminal defense lawyers until they need one or a loved one needs one, and then we're the bee's knees. So MACDL is very busy. I think we're not as big as people think we are. I'm the only staff member, so I don't think we're as our reach is very limited compared to, I think, the need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, and today I have the pleasure of talking with Tina Natto, who is a criminal defense attorney in Maine and also the executive director of what I've just learned to call MACDL, the Maine Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we're talking about the current political landscape, the role of law, the rule of law, and we're going to get into talking in the second half of the show about resistance. So one of the things, Tina, you are a lawyer. One of the things I talk with a lawyer friend of mine about a lot is the mightiness of the rule of law to stand up to authoritarian or fascist tendencies in the government. And so you've just described that MACDO, the Maine Criminal Defense Lawyers Association's investment in the legislature, in policy, in the legal framework that governs our lives and that defines for us what is acceptable behavior and what is criminalized behavior. And so I'm curious about thinking back to your description of our current political reality under the new administration. Do you think, is it your feeling that the role and the rule of law is going to be enough to protect us from the removal of due process for every person? I mean, we've already seen some very terrifying and frightening cases. We've seen the court's rule that Garcia's abduction to El Salvador was illegal in violation of the Constitution, and the federal government is refusing to obey. And so that feels terrifying as to our faith in our court system and in the role of our court system to defend personal liberties. So my question is, where is your level of optimism or pessimism about the extent to which our current legal structure is going to offer protections aligned with our constitutional rights?
I think if the system in general upheld people's rights, I would have more confidence in their ability to withstand the onslaught from the Trump administration. But that's just not true. I think people have been discarded and ground up by the legal system in America as long as it's existed. It's a huge problem. I think where we start to get really concerned is when you have someone who's completely untethered to ethics, morality, the law, who's essentially wanting to be a dictator and have no one tell him no, who's so ignorant of the system or so dismissive of it, disrespectful, whatever the word is, it gets really dangerous. It gets even more dangerous because there's nothing to hold them to account if the courts cannot enforce orders, holding back the administration's worst impulses. And there are many of them. The fact that I think this recent decision, and I'm no expert in immigration law, but the fact that the court order said basically, you need to facilitate the return of this individual. And if the administration could just give two middle fingers up to that judge, they would have. I mean, that's been their response. I really don't know how the contempt proceedings are going to play out. I'm very concerned in general. I do think in the federal courts, most judges are trying to do the right thing. But I think the legislature, the Congress is going to have to get involved and figure out ways that we can enforce things that limit the supposed unlimited power of the executive at this point. It's really, I think that's unprecedented to have a president who's so, he just doesn't care. It's his way or the highway. And I don't think the Constitution was made to really handle that. At least it's never been forced to at this level.
Thanks. So let's turn to resistance and protest. I know that that's not your area of expertise. Your area of expertise is defense, and it's defending people who are accused of criminalized behaviors.
And defending protesters, yes.
And defending protesters. So that's where I'm going. You know, given what you've just said about the protections afforded to us by the Constitution, the flagrant disregard of those protections by the current administration, what would you see as avenues of resistance for people who are deeply and profoundly concerned about the dictatorial tendencies in which our current administration is moving? Do you see avenues of resistance that seem more available to you from the vantage point of somebody who might be defending protesters who take those avenues?
I mean, I think it's important for people to speak out, but speaking out is simply not enough. I'm in a bubble with a lot of lawyers who seem to think if they issue a statement, it's somehow mean something to people on the ground or it'll make some sort of difference. I mean, if it makes you feel better, I guess there's some benefit to it. But similarly, you know, I've represented people who have protested at like Black Lives Matter protests, and those got extremely violent. I'm seeing a difference between real protests and parades, which is essentially protests that are permitted. So if you're participating in a parade or a protest that has a permit, I mean, you're being already given permission by the government. So I saw the signs, I saw the demonstrators at the rally or the parade, the weekend before last. And I'm glad people feel like they can express themselves and, stand up for what they believe in. I don't know the true impact of that. We're in a very liberal bubble here in Portland and in parts of Maine. I don't think our very white populace is under threat of getting hurt by police in the way that these things are being done. I think if it was a Free Palestine protest, I think if it was a Black Lives Matter protest, as I've seen, the threat of violence from the state is very, very real. So I think people have to do the things that they're comfortable with, but also recognize that words are not enough. What are the things that are most important to you? How do you lean on your elected officials? How do you donate to organizations that actually have the people on the ground that can do this work, that are providing direct aid to the people, again, most affected by these fascist policies and declarations? Alumni of, say, Columbia University, I would hope that they stand up and honestly want to burn things to the ground the way that university has just turned on its back. It's wild to me that a place of such power and prestige so easily was rolled. There's a lot that people can do. There is some benefit to performative activism, but at the end of the day, that's not enough. So Instagram posts are great. Hanging out at a permitted parade or a rally, great. See your friends, make these awesome, funny signs. But that's not the thing that's going to affect change, especially when we're already so bubbled up here in Portland. I think it has to be more than that. And I really think white people in the state need to look to leaders in the communities that are most directly affected and recognize our own privilege and step back and let other people tell us what are the priorities and how we can best support those priorities, as opposed to just taking the lead because we think that's where we belong.
So when protesters find themselves in contexts that escape the bounded parameters of the permitted parade,
yes,
this turns violent.
Yes.
When a protest is met with severe police response,
yes,
turns violent. When a protest turns into breaking windows, or as we saw during some of the George Floyd uprisings, vandalism of icons of corporate capitalism, for example, where people are kettled into a position of having to defend themselves and hit with tear gas and arrested en masse as a way of quelling the dissent, as a way of quelling the protest. What is the advice? And you're not giving legal advice on this show. This is not legal advice. I'm very clear about that. But from your personal experience and from your deep knowledge, watching these sorts of protests unfold and defending people who participated in them, what should protesters do?
So I really think it depends on the goal of the individual protester. For a lot of people, protesting and being arrested might be the goal of the protest. They want to be pulled into the system. They want that publicity. They want to fight the system through that avenue. And if that's the case, more power to you. I think knowing your rights throughout that whole process, getting a lawyer to advise you maybe before, but certainly after any arrest is a really, really smart idea for those people. I don't think that's most people. I think in the last Justice Radio segment I recorded, I said, I think most people want to be heard, but not hurt. If you're at a protest and things are starting to kind of go sideways, walking away is always an option. I think it's really important for people to record, if possible, to bear witness to violence being wrought against your colleagues and your fellow protesters. but I don't want people in harm's way. And I think if people are trying to avoid arrest, if police tell you to leave or disperse, that's what you're going to do. Because even if the police are wrong to do and say the things that they're doing and saying, they can and they will arrest you. And you're not going to talk your way out of an arrest. You're certainly not going to fight your way out of an arrest. So if you're that concerned about getting arrested and being brought to jail, unfortunately, the law is not on your side to resist at that point. It's concerning, but it's the way it is. The police are the kings of the street under our law.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've heard is do not take your phone to a protest because you can have your phone subject to search even against your will, even if you don't give consent. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, again, with these with these permitted rallies or parades, I see a lot of pictures. People are taking pictures of everyone. It's very public. I think when you're dealing with more marginalized communities, when the activism is really geared towards Black folk, trans folk, Palestinians, etc., these protests can get really dangerous really quickly. And there's ways for law enforcement to monitor cell phones. You might have heard of like the fusion centers that are in each state that can kind of monitor political activism that they deem terroristic in any way. So phones can be an issue. Taking pictures of fellow protesters could be very dangerous. And, you know, especially people are not masked and stuff. When I'm seeing a lot of photographs of people who might not have consented to having their photograph taken, I think we need to remember that not everyone is as safe as, for example, someone like me, like a middle-aged white woman with a law degree, right? Like, I'm pretty safe probably no matter what protests I'm at. That's not true for people who are at a lot of these protests. So we have to be protective of them as well.
And talk about the message on your shirt and how that's relevant.
Okay.
Yeah,
so on my shirt, a great shirt by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. They have a great line of clothing. It says, shh, and it says that is from Ernesto Miranda from 1966. So I think everyone knows what Miranda rights are. And the big one is the right to remain silent, hence the shh. And the right to remain silent exists at all times, whether you are under arrest or not, you can always shut the blank up. And that is legal advice. That's legal advice I give to anyone at any time. Do not speak to law enforcement. Please do not speak to law enforcement unless it's to say, am I free to go? Other than that, do not engage. It's not going to help you, but it could hurt you.
And with that, we are concluding our show. Thank you, Tina. This was a great conversation, lots to think about. With thanks also to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, to Aaron Pyle, our sound engineer, and to Daria Cullen, our executive producer. I'm Catherine Besteman. We are Justice Radio.